Nothing has changed, she replies. Before I can respond, the judge takes the bench. He looks from me, clearly in the middle of a charged conversation with my client, to Odette across the room. Are the parties ready to proceed? He asks. Your Honor, Ruth says. I would like to get rid of my lawyer. I am pretty sure Judge Thunder thought nothing else in this trial could surprise him until this moment. Ms. Jefferson, why on earth would you want to discharge your lawyer when the defense has rested? All that's left is a closing argument. Ruth's jaw works. It's personal, Your Honor. I would strongly recommend otherwise, Ms. Jefferson. She knows the case, and contrary to all expectation, she has been very prepared. She has your best interests in mind. It is my job to run this trial and to make sure it's no longer delayed. We have a jury sitting in the box that has heard all the evidence. We don't have time for you to go find another attorney, and you are not equipped to represent yourself. He faces me. Unbelievably, I am granting you another half-hour recess, Ms. McQuarrie, so you and your client can make nice. I deputize Howard to stay with Edison so that the press can't get near him. Getting to our usual conference room will require running past the press, too, so instead, I take Ruth out a back entrance and into the ladies' room. Sorry, I say to a woman following us, and I lock the door behind us. Ruth leans against the bank of sinks and folds her arms. I know you think nothing's changed, and maybe it hasn't for you. But for me, it has, I say. I hear you, loud and clear. I may not deserve it, but I'm begging you to give me one last chance. Why should I? Ruth asks, a challenge. Because I told you once I don't see color, and now it's all I see. She starts for the door. I don't need your pity. You're right, I nod. You need equity. Ruth stops walking, still facing away from me. You mean equality, she corrects. No, I mean equity. Equality is treating everyone the same. But equity is taking differences into account so everyone has a chance to succeed. I look at her. The first one sounds fair. The second one is fair. It's equal to give a printed test to two kids, but if one's blind and one's sighted, that's not true. You ought to give one a braille test and one a printed test, which both cover the same material. All this time, I've been giving the jury a print test because I didn't realize that they're blind. That I was blind. Please, Ruth. I think you'll like hearing what I have to say. Slowly, Ruth turns around. One last chance, she agrees. When I stand up, I'm not alone. Yes. There is a courtroom waiting for my closing argument. But I'm surrounded by the stories that have blazed through the media but have mostly been ignored in courts of law. The stories of Tamir Rice, of Michael Brown, of Trayvon Martin, of Eric Garner and Walter Scott and Freddie Gray, of Sandra Bland and John Crawford III, of the female African-American soldiers who wanted to wear their hair natural, and the children in the Seattle school district who were told by the Supreme Court that cherry-picking students to maintain racial diversity was unconstitutional. Of minorities in the South who've been left without federal protection while those states put laws into effect that limit their voting rights. Of the millions of African Americans who have been victims of housing discrimination and job discrimination. Of the homeless black boy on Chapel Street, whose cup is never going to be as full as that of a white homeless woman. I turn toward the jury. What if, ladies and gentlemen, today I told you that anyone here who was born on a Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday was free to leave right now? Also, They'd be given the most central parking spots in the city and the biggest houses. They would get job interviews before others who were born later in the week, and they'd be taken first at the doctor's office, no matter how many patients were waiting in line. If you were born from Thursday to Sunday, you might try to catch up. But because you were straggling behind, the press would always point to how inefficient you are. And if you complained, you'd be dismissed for playing the birthday card. I shrug. Seems silly, right? But what if, on top of these arbitrary systems that inhibited your chances for success, everyone kept telling you that things were actually pretty equal? I walked toward them, continuing. I told you when we started this case that it was about Ruth Jefferson being presented with an impossible choice: to do her job as a nurse or to defy her supervisor's orders. I told you that evidence would show Davis Bauer had underlying health conditions that led to his death. And that is true, ladies and gentlemen. But this case, it's about a lot more than I let on to you. Out of all the people who interacted with Davis Bauer at Mercy West Haven Hospital during his short life, only one of them is sitting in this courtroom at the defense table: Ruth Jefferson. Only one person is being charged with a crime: Ruth Jefferson. I spent an entire trial skirting a very important question. Why? Ruth is black, I say flatly. That rubbed Turk Bauer, a white supremacist, the wrong way. He can't stand black people, or Asian people, or gay people, or anyone else who isn't like him. And as a result, he set into motion a chain of events that would lead to Ruth becoming a scapegoat for the tragic death of his son. But we are not supposed to talk about race in the criminal justice system. We're supposed to pretend it is merely the icing on the cake of whatever charge has been brought to the table, not the substance of it. We are supposed to be the legal guardians of a post-racial society. But you know, the word ignorance has an even more important word at its heart: ignore. And I don't think it's right to ignore the truth any longer. I look right at juror number 12, the teacher. Finish this sentence, I say. I am... I pause at the blank. Maybe you'd say shy, or blonde, friendly, nervous, intelligent, Irish. But the majority of you wouldn't say white. Why not? Because it's a given. It's identity that is taken for granted. Those of us who were lucky enough to be born white are oblivious to that good fortune. Now, we're all blissfully unmindful of lots of things. Probably you did not give thanks for showering this morning or for having a roof over your head last night, for eating breakfast and having clean underwear. That's because all those invisible privileges are easy to take in stride. Sure, it's so much easier to see the headwinds of racism, the ways that people of color are discriminated against. We see it now when a black man is accidentally shot by the police and a girl with brown skin is bullied by classmates for wearing a hijab. It's a little harder to see and to own up to the tailwinds of racism, the ways that those of us who aren't people of color have benefited just because we're white. We can go to a movie and be pretty certain that most of the main characters will look like us. We can be late for a meeting and not have it be blamed on our race. I can go into Judge Thunder's chambers and raise an objection and not be told I'm playing the race card. I pause. The vast majority of us do not come home from work and say, "Hooray, I didn't get stopped and frisked today." The vast majority of us did not get into college and think, "I got into the school of my choice because the educational system really works in my favor." We don't think these things because we don't have to. By now, the jury is getting uneasy. They shift and shuffle, and from the corner of my eye, I see Judge Thunder regarding me narrowly. Even though a closing argument is mine alone to give, and theoretically, if I wanted to read Great Expectations out loud, I could. I know you're thinking, I'm not racist. Why, we even had an example of what we think real racism looks like in the form of Turk Bauer. I doubt there are many of you on the jury who, like Turk, believe that your children are Aryan warriors or that black people are so inferior they should not even be able to touch a white baby. But even if we took every white supremacist on the planet and shipped them off to Mars, there would still be racism. That's because racism isn't just about hate. We all have biases, even if we don't think we do. It's because racism is also about who has power and who has access to it. When I started working on this case, ladies and gentlemen, I didn't see myself as a racist. Now I realize I am. Not because I hate people of different races, but because, intentionally or unintentionally, I've gotten a boost from the color of my skin. Just like Ruth Jefferson suffered a setback because of hers. Odette is sitting with her head bowed at the prosecution table. I can't tell if she is delighted that I am building my own coffin out of words, or if she is simply stunned that I have the balls to antagonize the jury at this late stage of the game. There is a difference between active and passive racism. It's kind of like when you get on the moving walkway at the airport. If you walk down it, you're going to get to the other end faster than if you just stand still. But you're ultimately going to wind up in the same spot. Active racism is having a swastika tattoo on your head. Active racism is telling a nurse supervisor that an African-American nurse can't touch your baby. It's snickering at a black joke. But passive racism? It's noticing there's only one person of color in your office and not asking your boss why. It's reading your kid's fourth grade curriculum and seeing that the only black history covered is slavery and not questioning why. It's defending a woman in court whose indictment directly resulted from her race and glossing over that fact like it hardly matters. I bet you feel uncomfortable right now. You know? So do I. It's hard to talk about this stuff without offending people or feeling offended. It's why lawyers like me aren't supposed to say these things to juries like you. But deep down, if you've asked yourself what this trial is really about, you know it's more than just whether Ruth had anything to do with the death of one of her patients. In fact, it has very little to do with Ruth. It's about systems that have been in place for about 400 years. Systems meant to make sure that people like Turk can make a heinous request as a patient and have it granted. Systems meant to make sure that people like Ruth are kept in their place. I turn to the jury, beseeching. If you don't want to think about this, you don't have to, and you can still acquit Ruth. I've given you enough medical evidence to show that there's plenty of doubt about what led to that baby's death. You heard the medical examiner himself say that had the newborn screening results come back in a more timely fashion, Davis Bauer might be alive today. Yes, you also heard Ruth get angry on the stand. That's because when you wait 44 years to be given a chance to speak, things don't always come out the way you want them to. Ruth Jefferson just wanted the chance to do her job. To take care of that infant like she was trained to do. I turn finally toward Ruth. She breathes in, and I feel it in my own chest. What if people who were born on Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday were never the subjects of extensive credit checks when they applied for loans? What if they could shop without fear of security tailing them? I pause. What if their newborn screening test results came back to the pediatrician in a timely manner, allowing medical intervention that could prevent their deaths? Suddenly, I say, that type of arbitrary discrimination doesn't seem quite so silly, does it?
Ruth. After all that. After months of telling me that race doesn't belong in a court of law, Kennedy McQuarrie took the elephant in the room and paraded it in front of the judge. She squeezed it into the jury box so that those men and women couldn't help but feel the pinch. I stare at the jury, all lost in thought and utterly silent. Kennedy comes to sit down beside me, and for a moment, I just look at her. My throat works while I try to put into words everything I am feeling. What Kennedy said to all those strangers, it's been the narrative of my life, the outline inside of which I have lived. But I could have screamed it from the rooftops, and it wouldn't have done any good. For the jurors to hear it, really hear it, it had to be said by one of their own. She turns to me before I can speak. Thank you, she says, as if I'm the one who's done her the favor. Come to think of it, maybe I have. The judge clears his throat, and we both look up to find him glaring. Odette Lawton has risen and is standing in the spot Kennedy just vacated. I stroke my mother's lucky scarf, looped around my neck, as she begins to speak. You know, I admire Ms. McQuarrie and her rousing cry for social justice, but that's not what we're here for today. We are here because the defendant, Ruth Jefferson, abandoned the ethical code of her profession as a labor and delivery nurse and did not adequately respond to an infant's medical crisis. The prosecutor approaches the jury. What Ms. McQuarrie said, it's true. People have prejudices, and sometimes they make decisions that don't make sense to us. When I was in high school, I worked at McDonald's. This surprises me. I try to imagine Odette timing fries, but I can't. I was the only black kid working there. There were times I'd be at the register, and I would see a customer walk in, look at me, and then go into another cashier's line to place their order. How did that make me feel? She shrugs. Not so great. But did I spit in their food? No. Did I drop the burger on the floor and then tuck it into the bun? No. I did my job. I did what I was supposed to do. Now let's look at Ruth Jefferson, shall we? She had a customer choose another line, so to speak. But did she continue to do what she was supposed to do? No. She did not take the directive to not care for Davis Bauer in stride as a simple patient request. She blew it up into a racial incident. She did not honor her Nightingale pledge to assist her patients no matter what. She acted with complete disregard to the infant's welfare because she was angry, and she took her anger out on that poor child. It's true, ladies and gentlemen, that Marie Malone's directive to excuse Ruth as a caretaker for Davis Bauer was a racist decision, but it is not Marie on trial here for her actions. It is Ruth for not adhering to the vow she made as a nurse. It's true, too, that many of you were made uncomfortable by Mr. Bauer and his beliefs, because they are extreme. In this country, he is allowed to express those views, even when they make others feel uneasy. But if you are going to say you are unnerved by how Turk Bauer is filled with hate, you must admit that Ruth, too, is filled with hate. You heard it when she told you it was better for that baby to die than to grow up like his father. Perhaps that was the only moment she was candid with us. At least Turk Bauer is honest about his beliefs, as unpalatable as they may seem. Because Ruth, we know, is a liar. By her own admission, she did intervene and touch the infant in the nursery, in spite of telling her supervisor and risk management and the police that she did not. Ruth Jefferson started to save this baby. And what made her stop? Fear for her job. She put her own interests in front of the patients, which is exactly what a medical professional should never do. The prosecutor pauses. Ruth Jefferson and her attorney can throw up a dog and pony show about tardy lab results or the state of race relations in this country or anything else, she says. But it doesn't change the facts of this case, and it's never going to bring that baby back to life. Once the judge has given instructions to the jury, they are led from the courtroom. Judge Thunder leaves, too, Howard jumps up.
I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah, and you probably never will again, Kennedy mutters.
I mean, it was like watching Tom Cruise. You can't handle the truth.
Like shooting myself in the foot, Kennedy finished. On purpose. I put my hand on her arm. I know what you said back there cost you, I say. Kennedy stares at me soberly. Ruth, it's most likely going to cost you more. She has explained to me that because the murder charge was thrown out before I testified, the jury has only the negligent homicide charge to decide. Although our medical evidence definitely creates reasonable doubt, an outburst of anger is like a poker burned into a juror's mind. Even if they're not deciding on the premeditated murder charge now, they might still feel like I didn't care for that baby as well as I possibly could. And whether that was even possible under the circumstances, I don't know anymore. I think about the night I spent in jail. I imagine spinning it out into many nights, weeks, months. I think about Liza Lott and how the conversation I have with her now would be very different from the one I had back then. I would start by saying that I'm not naive anymore. I have been forged in a crucible like steel. And the miracle about steel is that you can hammer it so thin it's stretched to its limit. But that doesn't mean it will break. It was still worth hearing, I tell Kennedy. She smiles a little. It was worth saying. Suddenly, Odette Lawton is standing in front of us. I panic slightly. Kennedy also said that there was one other alternative the prosecutor might choose, to throw out all charges and start over with a grand jury, using my testimony to show malice in the heat of the moment, and with a new charge of second-degree murder. I'm getting the case against Edison Jefferson dismissed, Odette says briskly. I thought you'd want to know. My jaw drops. Of everything I thought she might say, that was not it. She faces me, and for the first time in this trial, meets my gaze. Except for our bathroom run-in, she has not made direct eye contact with me the entire time I was sitting at the defense table, glancing just past me or over my head. Kennedy says that's standard. It's the way prosecutors remind defendants they're not human. It works. I have a 15-year-old daughter, Odette says. A fact and an explanation. She turns to Kennedy. Nice closing, counselor, she says, and she walks away. Now what? I ask. Kennedy takes a deep breath. Now, she says, we wait. But first we have the press to deal with. Howard and Kennedy formulate a plan to get me out of the courthouse with no media contact. If we aren't able to avoid them completely, she explains, the correct answer is no comment. We are waiting for the jury's decision. Period. I nod at her. I don't think you get it, Ruth. They're going to be out for blood. They're going to pick at you and goad you into exploding so that they can get it on tape. For the next 5 minutes until you leave this building, you are blind, deaf, dumb. You understand? Yes, I tell her. My heart is a drum as we push through the double doors of the courtroom. Immediately there are flashes of lights and microphones thrust in my face. Howard runs interference, shoving them away as Kennedy barrels us through this circus. Acrobat reporters trying to reach over the heads of others to get a statement. Clowns doing their act. The Bowers in a heated interview with one conservative news station. And me, trying to navigate my tightrope without falling. Approaching us from the opposite direction is Wallace Mercy. He and his supporters have formed a human blockade, elbows locked, which means we will have to engage. Wallace and a woman stand in the middle. As I watch, they step forward to lead the rest. The woman wears a pink wool suit. Her close-cropped hair is dyed a hot red. She stands straight as an arrow, her arm tightly tucked through Wallace's. I look to Kennedy. A silent question. What do we do? But my question is answered for me. Wallace and the woman do not come toward us. Instead, they veer to the far side of the hallway where Turk Bauer is still in conversation with a reporter, his wife and father-in-law standing by his side. Brittany, the woman says, her eyes filling with tears.
Oh, Lord, look at how beautiful you are.
She reaches toward Brittany Bauer as the cameras roll. But we are not in Judge Thunder's court, and she can say or do anything she pleases. So I see this woman's hand coming toward her as if in slow motion, and I know even before it happens that Brittany Bauer will push her away.
Get the hell away from me!
Wallace Mercy steps forward.
I think this is someone you want to meet, Ms. Bauer.
She doesn't need to, Wallace, the woman murmurs. We met 26 years ago when I gave birth to her. Britt, honey, you remember me, don't you?
Brittany Bauer's face blooms with color, shame or anger or both. Liar! You disgusting liar!
She lunges for the older woman who goes down too easily. People scramble to pull Brittany away, to lift the woman to safety. I hear shouts,
help her! And are you getting this on tape?
Then I hear someone cry, stop! The voice is deep and powerful and commanding. And just like that, Britt falls back. She turns around, feral, glaring at her father.
You're just gonna let that nigger say those things about me? About us?
But her father is no longer looking at his daughter. He is ashen, staring at the woman who now stands with Wallace Mercy's contingent, Wallace's handkerchief pressed to her bleeding lip.
Hello, Adele, he says. I did not see this coming, I whisper, glancing at Kennedy. That's how I realize she did.
Turk. The cameras are rolling when all hell breaks loose. 1 minute, Britt and Francis are standing next to me, listening to me tell some right-wing radio personality that we have only just begun to fight, and then it becomes a literal declaration. A black woman marches up to Britt and touches her arm. Naturally, Britt recoils, and then the woman lobs a blatant lie that Brittany Bauer, the princess of the white power movement, is actually half black. I look to Francis the way I have, well, for years. He taught me everything I know about hate. I would go to war beside him. In fact, I have. I step back, waiting for Francis to let loose with his famous rhetoric, to cut this bitch down to size as an opportunist who wants her 15 minutes of fame. Except he doesn't. He says the name of Brittany's mother. I do not know much about Adele, because Britt doesn't either. Just her name and the fact that she cheated on Francis with a black dude, and he was so furious that he gave her an ultimatum. Leave him the baby and disappear from their lives forever, or die in your sleep. Wisely, she chose the former, and that was all Britt needed to know about her. But I look at Britt's long, dark hair. We see what we're told to see. She glances up, looking at Francis, too.
Daddy?
Suddenly, I can't breathe. I don't know who my wife is. I don't know who I am. For years, I would have easily said I'd knife someone black before I'd sit down for coffee with them. And all this time, I've been living with one. I made a baby with one. Which means my own son, he was part black too. There's a buzzing in my ears that feels like I'm free-falling, dropped from the airplane without a parachute. The ground is rushing up at me. Brittany stands up, turning in a circle, her face pinched so tight it breaks my heart. Baby, Francis offers, and she makes a low sound, deep in her throat.
No,
she says.
No!
Then she runs. She is small, and she is fast. Britt can move in and out of shadows, and why shouldn't she be able to? I mean, she learned, like me, from the best. Francis tried to get the lonewolf.org members who've been at court in solidarity to help us search for Britt, but there is a wall between us now. Some have already disappeared. I have no doubt that they will discontinue their user accounts, unless Francis can do enough damage control to stop them. I am not sure that I even care. I just want to find my wife. We drive everywhere looking for her. Our network, invisible but wide, is no longer available. We are alone in this, completely isolated. Be careful what you wish for, I guess. As I drive, searching the far corners of this city, I turn and look at Francis. You feel like telling me the truth? It was a long time ago, he says quietly, before I joined the movement. I met Adele at a diner. She served me pie. She put her name and phone number on the bill. I called. He shrugs. 3 months later, she was pregnant. I feel my stomach turn as I think about sleeping with one of them. But then, I had done that, hadn't I? God help me, Turk, I loved her. Didn't matter if we were out dancing halfway into the night or sitting at home watching television. I got to the point where I just didn't feel whole if she wasn't with me. And then we had Brit and I started to get scared. It felt perfect, you know? And perfect means that something's bound to go wrong. He rubs his forehead. She went to church on Sunday, same church she'd gone to as a kid. A black church with all that singing and hallelujah shit. I couldn't take it. I went fishing instead and told her that was my holy place. But the choir director, he started taking an interest in Adele. Told her she had the voice of an angel. They started spending a lot of time together, practicing all hours of the day or night. He shakes his head. I don't know, maybe I went a little crazy. I accused her of cheating on me. Maybe she did, maybe she didn't. I messed her up some, which was wrong, I know. But I couldn't help it, she was tearing me apart, and I had to do something with all that hurt. You know what that's like, right? I nod. She ran to this other guy for comfort, and he took her in. Jesus, Turk, I drove her right to him. Next thing I know, she says she's leaving me. I tell her that if she goes, it's empty-handed. I am not letting her take my daughter away from me. I say that if she tries, it'll be the last thing she ever does. He looks at me. Bleak. I never saw her again. And you never told Brit? He shakes his head. What was I going to say? I threatened to kill her mother? No. I started taking Brit to bars, leaving her in a car seat asleep while I went in to get drunk. That's where I met Tom Metzger. I find it hard to imagine the leader of the White Alliance Army slugging a beer, but stranger things have happened. He was with some of his guys. He saw me get into my car and refused to let me drive home when he saw Brit in the back. He drove us to my place and said I needed to get my act together for my kid. I was sloppy drunk by then. I told him how Adele had left me for a nigger. I guess I never mentioned that she was one, too. Anyway, Tom gave me something to read, a pamphlet. Francis purses his lips. That was the start. It was so much easier to hate them than to hate myself. My high beams cut across a train track, the place where Francis's squad used to hold court back when they were active. And now, Francis says, I'm going to lose her, too. She knows how to cover her tracks, how to disappear. I taught her. He is riding a ragged edge of pain and shock, and frankly, I don't have time for Francis's breakdown. I have more important things to do, like find my wife, and I have one more idea. We have to break into the graveyard. It's after dark now, and the gates are locked. I scale the fence and hack at the lock with a sledgehammer from the back of my rig so that Francis can get inside, too. We let our eyes adjust because we know Brit might run at the glimpse of a flashlight. At first I can't see her at all. It's that dark, and she is wearing a navy dress. But then I hear movement as I draw closer to Davis's grave. For a moment the clouds covering the moon part, and the headstone gleams. There is a glint of metal, too. Don't come any closer, Brit says. I hold up my palms, a white flag. Very slowly, I take another step. She slashes out once. It's a penknife, one she carries in her purse. I remember the day she bought it, at a white power rally. She had held up various models, brandishing onyx, mother of pearl. She'd pressed a bedazzled one against my throat in a mock charge. Which is more me? She had teased. Hey, baby, I say gently. It's time to come home. I can't. I'm a mess, she mutters. That's okay. I crouch down, moving the way I would if I were approaching a wild dog. I reach for her hand, but my palm slips out of hers. I look down and see mine is bloody.
Jesus Christ!
I cry, just as Francis shines his iPhone flashlight down on Britt from behind me and lets out a cry. She is sitting with her back against Davis's grave. Her eyes are wide and wild, glassy. Her left arm has been sliced deeply 7 or 8 times.
I can't find it, she says. I keep trying to get it out.
Get what out, sweetheart? I say, reaching for the blade again. But she curls it away from me.
Her blood!
As I watch, she picks up the knife and slashes her wrist. The knife falls out of Britt's hand, and as her eyes roll back in her head, I lift her in my arms and start running to my truck. It's a while before Britt is stable again, and that's a generous term. We are at Yale, New Haven, a different hospital than the one where she delivered Davis. Her lacerations have been stitched. Her wrist has been wrapped. The blood has been washed from her body. She has been admitted to the psych ward, and I have to say I'm grateful. I can't unravel the knots in her mind. I can barely unravel the knots in mine. I tell Francis to go home, get some rest. Me, I'll stay overnight in the visitor's lounge just to make sure if Britt wakes up and needs me, she will know someone is here for her. But right now, she is unconscious, knocked out with sedatives. A hospital after midnight is ghostly. Lights are low and sounds are eerie. The squeak of a nurse's shoes, the moan of a patient, the beep and exhale of a blood pressure machine. I buy a knit cap from the gift store, one that has been knit for chemo patients, but I don't care. It covers my tattoo, and right now I want to blend in. I sit in the cafeteria nursing a cup of coffee and combing through the tangle of my thoughts. There's only so many things you can hate. There are only so many people you can beat up, so many nights you can get drunk, so many times you can blame other people for your own bullshit. It's a drug, and like any drug, it stops working, and then what? My head actually aches from holding 3 incompatible truths in it. 1, black people are inferior. 2, Britt is half black. 3, I love Britt with all my heart. Shouldn't numbers 1 and 2 make number 3 impossible? Or is she the exception to the rule? Was Adele 1 too? I think of me and Twinkie dreaming of the food we craved behind bars. How many exceptions do there have to be before you start to realize that maybe the truths you've been told aren't actually true? When I finish my coffee, I wander the halls of the hospital. I read a discarded newspaper in the lobby. I watch the flashing ambulance lights through the glass doors of the ER. I stumble upon the preemie NICU by accident. Believe me, I don't want to be anywhere near a birthing pavilion. Those scars are still tender for me, even if this is a different hospital. But I stand at the window beside another man. "She's mine," he says, pointing to a painfully small infant in a pink blanket. "Her name is Cora." I panic a little. What creep hangs out in front of a nursery if he's not related to one of the babies? So I point to a kid in a blue blanket. There's a bit of a glare through his incubator, but even from here I can see the brown of his skin. "Davis," I lie. My son was as white as I am, at least on the outside. He did not look like this newborn. But even if he had, now I realize I would have loved him. The truth is, if that baby were Davis, it wouldn't matter that his skin is darker than mine. It would just matter that he's alive. I bury my shaking hands in my coat, thinking of Francis and of Britt. Maybe however much you've loved someone, that's how much you can hate. It's like a pocket turned inside out. It stands to reason that the opposite should be true, too.
Kennedy. In the time that it takes for the jury to return a verdict, I sit through 40 more arraignments, 38 of which are black men. Micah performs 6 surgeries. Violet goes to a birthday party. I read an article on the front page of the paper about a march at Yale by students of color who want, among other things, to rechristen a residential college currently named for John C. Calhoun, a U.S. vice president who supported slavery and secession. For 2 days, Ruth and I sit at the courthouse and wait. Edison goes back to school, knuckling down with renewed enthusiasm. It's amazing what a little brush with the law can do for a kid who's flirting with delinquency. Ruth also has, with my blessing and with me at her side, appeared on Wallace Mercy's television show via remote camera. He championed her bravery and handed her a check to cover some of the money she had lost from being out of work for months. Donations from people as close as East End and as far as Johannesburg. Afterward, we read notes that were enclosed with some of the contributions. I think about you and your boy. I don't have much, but I want you to know you're not alone. Thank you for being brave enough to stand up when I didn't. We've heard about Brittany Bauer, who is suffering from what the prosecution calls stress, and Ruth calls just plain crazy. No one has seen hide nor hair of Turk Bauer or Francis Mitchum. How did you know? Ruth had asked me, immediately after the debacle that occurred when Wallace brought Adele Adams to the courthouse to accidentally cross paths with Francis and his daughter. I had a hunch, I told her. I was looking through the neonatal screening, and I saw something none of us noticed before because we were so focused on the MCADD. Sickle cell anemia. I remembered what the neonatologist said about how that particular disease hits the African-American community harder than others. And I also remembered Britt saying during her deposition that she never knew her mother. That's quite a long shot, Ruth had said. Yeah, that's why I did a little digging. 1 in 12 African-Americans carry the sickle cell trait. 1 in 10,000 white people carry it. Suddenly, it looked less like a wild card. So, I called Wallace. The rest, that's on him. He found out the name of the mother from Britt's birth certificate and tracked her down. Ruth had looked at me. But it had nothing to do with your case, really. Nope, I admitted. That one, it was a gift from you to me. I figured there wasn't anything that could put a finer point on the hypocrisy of it all. Now, as we come to the close of the second day with no word from the jury, we're all going a little stir-crazy. What are you doing? I ask Howard, who has been keeping the vigil with us. He has been typing furiously into his phone. Hot date? I've been looking up the sentencing difference for possession of crack versus cocaine, he says. Up until 2010, a person convicted of possession with intent to distribute 50 grams or more of crack got a minimum of 10 years in prison. To get the same sentence for cocaine, you had to distribute 5,000 grams. Even now, the sentencing disparity ratio is 18 to 1. I shake my head. Why do you need to know this? I'm thinking about appeal, he says brightly. That's clearly a precedent for prejudice in sentencing, since 84% of people convicted for crack offenses are black, and black drug offenders are 20% more likely to be imprisoned than white drug offenders. Howard, I say, rubbing my temples, turn off your damn phone. This is bad, right? Ruth says. She rubs her arms, although the radiator is belching and it's broiling in the room. If they were going to acquit, it would have been quick, I bet. No news is good news. I lie. At the end of the day, the judge calls the jury back into the courtroom.
Have you arrived at a verdict?
The forewoman stands.
No, Your Honor, we're split.
I know the judge is going to give them an Allen charge, a glorified legal pep talk. He turns to the jury, imperial, to imbue them with resolve.
You know, the state has spent a great deal of money to put this trial on, and nobody knows the facts more than you all do. Talk to each other. Allow yourself to hear another's point of view. I encourage you to arrive at a verdict so that we do not have to go through this all over again.
The jury is dismissed, and I look at Ruth. You probably have to get back home. She looks at her watch. I have a little time, she admits. So we walk downtown, shoulder to shoulder, huddled against the cold to grab a cup of coffee. We slip out of the biting wind into the buzzy chatter of a local shop. After I realized I couldn't cut it as a pastry chef, I used to dream about opening a coffee place. I muse. I wanted to call it Grounds for Dismissal. We are the next order. I ask Ruth how she takes her coffee. Black, she says. And suddenly, we are both laughing so hard that the barista looks at us as if we are crazy, as if we are speaking a language she can't understand. Which, I guess, is not all that far from the truth. The next morning, Judge Thunder summons Odette and me to chambers. I got a note from the foreman. We have a hung jury. 11-1. He shakes his head. I'm very sorry, ladies. After he dismisses us, I find Howard pacing outside chambers. Well? Mistrial. They're deadlocked, 11-1. Who's the holdout? Howard asks. But it's a rhetorical question. He knows I don't have that information. Suddenly, though, we both stop walking and face each other. Juror number 12, we say simultaneously. $10, Howard asks. You're on, I tell him. I knew we should have used a peremptory strike on her. You haven't won that bet yet, I point out. But deep down, I imagine he's right. The teacher, who couldn't admit to having any implicit racism, would have been mightily offended by my closing argument. Ruth is waiting for me in the conference room. She looks up, hopeful. They can't reach a verdict, I say.
So now what?
That depends, I explain. The case can be tried again later with a new jury, or else Odette just gives up and doesn't pursue this any further.
Do you think she...
I learned a long time ago not to pretend I can think like a prosecutor, I admit. We're just going to have to see. In the courtroom, the jury files in, looking exhausted. Madam Foreman, the judge says, I understand that the jury has been unable to reach a verdict. Is that correct? The foreman stands. Yes, Your Honor. Do you feel that further time would enable you to resolve this case finally between the state and Ms. Jefferson? Unfortunately, Your Honor, some of us just cannot see eye to eye. Thank you for your service, Judge Thunder says. I am dismissing this jury. The men and women exit. In the gallery, there are hushed whispers, as people try to understand what this means. I try to figure out in my head the odds that Odette will go back to a grand jury for that involuntary manslaughter charge. There is still one final thing that needs to be done in this trial, Judge Thunder continues. I am prepared to rule on the defense's renewed motion for judgment of acquittal. Howard looks at me over Ruth's head.
What?
Holy shit. Judge Thunder is going to use the escape hatch I gave him as a matter of routine. I hold my breath.
I have researched the law and have reviewed the evidence in this case very carefully. There is no credible proof that the death of this child was causally related to any action or inaction of the defendants.
He faces Ruth.
I am very sorry you had to go through what you did at your workplace, ma'am.
He smacks his gavel.
I grant the defense's motion.
In this humbling moment, I learn that not only can I not think like a prosecutor, I am woefully off base about the mental machinations of a judge. I turn, a dazed laugh bubbling up inside me. Ruth's brow is furrowed. I don't understand. He hasn't declared a mistrial. He's granted a bona fide acquittal. Ruth, I say, grinning, you are
free to go.
Ruth. Freedom is the fragile neck of a daffodil after the longest of winters. It's the sound of your voice without anyone drowning you out. It's having the grace to say yes, and more important, the right to say no. At the heart of freedom, hope beats, a pulse of possibility. I am the same woman I was 5 minutes ago. I'm rooted to the same chair. My hands are flattened on the same scarred table. My lawyers are both still flanking me. That fluorescent light overhead is still spitting like a cockroach. Nothing has changed, and everything is different. In a daze, I walk out of the courtroom. A bumper crop of microphones blooms in front of me. Kennedy instructs everyone that although her client is obviously delighted with the verdict, we will not be making any statements until we give an official press conference tomorrow. That right now, her client has to get home to her son. There are a few stragglers, hoping for a soundbite, but eventually they drift away. There is a professor being arraigned down the hall for possession of child pornography. The world turns, and there's another victim, another bully. It's the arc of someone else's story now. I text Edison, who calls me even though he has to leave class to do it, and I listen to the relief braided through his words. I call Adisa at work and have to hold the phone away from my ear as she screams with joy. I'm interrupted by a text from Christina, a full row of smiling emojis, and then a hamburger and a glass of wine and a question mark. Rain check, I type back. Ruth, Kennedy says, when she finds me standing with my phone in my hand staring into space. You all right? I don't know, I reply, completely honest. Is it really over? Howard smiles. It is really, truly, unequivocally over. Thank you, I say. I embrace him. Then I face Kennedy. And you, I shake my head. I don't even know what to say. Think on it, Kennedy says, hugging me. You can tell me next week when we have lunch. I pull back, meeting her eyes. I'd like that, I say. And something shifts between us. It's power, I realize, and we are dead even. Suddenly I realize that in my astonishment at the verdict, I left my mother's lucky scarf in the courtroom. I forgot something. I'll meet you downstairs. When I reach the double doors, there's a bailiff stationed outside. Ma'am? I'm sorry, there was a scarf. Can I? Sure. He waves me inside. I'm alone in the courtroom. I walk down the aisle of the gallery, past the bar, to the spot where I was sitting. My mother's scarf is curled underneath the desk. I pick it up, feed it like a seam through my hands. I look around the empty chamber. One day Edison might be arguing a case here, instead of sitting next to a lawyer like I have been. One day, he might even be on the judge's bench. I close my eyes so that I can keep this minute with me. I listen to the silence. It feels like light years since I was brought into another courtroom down the hall for my arraignment, wearing shackles and a nightgown, and not allowed to speak for myself. It feels like forever since I was told what I could not do. Yes, I say softly, because it is the opposite of restraint. Because it breaks chains. Because I can. I ball my hands into fists and tilt back my head and let the word rip from my throat. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Stage 3. Afterbirth. 6 years later. People must learn to hate. And if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love. Nelson Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom. Turk. In the examination room at the clinic, I take a rubber glove out of the dispenser and blow it up, tying off the bottom. I take a pen and draw eyes, a beak.
Daddy,
My daughter says,
"You made me a chicken."
"Chicken?" I say. "I can't believe you think that's a chicken. That is clearly a rooster." She frowns.
"What's the difference?"
Well, I walked right into that one, didn't I? But there's no way I'm going to describe the birds and the bees to my 3-year-old while we're sitting waiting for her to get tested for strep. I'll let Deborah do that when she gets home from work. Deborah, my wife, is a stockbroker. I took her last name when we got married, hoping to start over as someone new, someone better. She's the one with the 9-to-5-er, while I stay at home with Karis and fit my speaking gigs around her playdates in her nursery school. I work with the local chapter of the Anti-Defamation League. I go to high schools and prisons and temples and churches, talking about hate. I tell these groups about how I used to beat people up because I was hurting so bad, and either I was going to hurt them or I was going to hurt myself. I explain that made me feel like I had a purpose. I tell them about the festivals I went to, where musicians sang about white supremacy and children played with racist games and toys. I describe my time in prison and my work as a webmaster for a hate site. I talk about my first wife. I say that hate ate her from the inside out, but what really happened was more mundane. A bottle of pills, swallowed with a bottle of vodka. She could never handle seeing the world as it really is, and so finally, she found a way to keep her eyes closed forever. I tell them that there is nothing more selfish than trying to change someone's mind because they don't think like you. Just because something is different does not mean it should not be respected. I tell them this, the part of the brain, physiologically, that allows us to blame everything on people we do not really know is the same part of the brain that allows us to have compassion for strangers. Yes, the Nazis made Jews the scapegoats to the point of near extinction, but that same bit of tissue in the mind is what led others to send money and supplies and relief, even when they were half a world away. In my talk, I describe the long road to leaving. It started with a visit in the middle of the night. Hooded, faceless individuals sent from others in power who broke down our door and beat us. Francis was thrown down a flight of stairs. Me, I had 3 broken ribs. It was our bon voyage party, I suppose. I shut down lonewolf.org the next day. Then there were the divorce papers I was having drawn up when Britt killed herself. Even now, I make mistakes. I still feel the need to slam into something or someone from time to time, but now I do it on the rink in an ice hockey league. I'm probably more cautious than I should be around black dudes, but I'm even more cautious with the white ones in the pickup trucks with Confederate flags hanging in the back windows, because I used to be who they are, and I know what they are capable of. Many of the groups I meet with do not believe that I could possibly have changed so dramatically. That's when I tell them about my wife. Deborah knows everything about me, my past. She has managed to forgive me, and if she can forgive me, how could I not try to forgive myself? I do penance. 3 to 4 times a week I relive my mistakes in front of an audience. I feel them hate me. I think I deserve it.
"Daddy," Karis says, "my throat hurts."
"I know, baby," I tell her. I pull her onto my lap just as the door opens. The nurse comes in, scanning Karis's intake form at this walk-in clinic.
"Hello," she says. "My name is Ruth Walker."
She looks up, a smile on her face. "Walker," I repeat as she shakes my hand.
"Yes, as in the Walker Clinic. I own the place, but I also work here," she grins. "Don't worry, I'm a much better nurse practitioner than I am a bookkeeper."
She doesn't recognize me. At least, I don't think she does. To be fair, it's Deborah's last name on the form on the clipboard. Plus, I look very different now. I've had all but one of my tattoos removed. My hair has grown out and is conservatively trimmed. I've lost about 30 pounds of muscle and brawn ever since I've taken up running. And maybe whatever's inside me now is casting a different reflection, too, on the outside. She turns to Karis.
"So, something doesn't feel good, huh? Can I take a look?"
She lets Kara sit on my lap as she runs gentle hands over my daughter's swollen glands and takes her temperature, and teases her into opening her mouth by staging a singing contest that Karis, of course, wins. I let my gaze wander around the room, noticing things I hadn't seen before. The diploma on the wall with the name Ruth Jefferson, written in calligraphy. The framed photo of a handsome black guy wearing a graduation cap and gown.